Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Okay, I'll tell my father that you're coming with us tomorrow.
Where are we going?
Nilbog, a wonderful half-empty town. Oh, Elliot, it will be wonderful.
Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and it's the exclusive home of the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Hey, Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan call you. Listen, I thought my acute paranoia syndrome would really help me now that I've made detective, but now I'm starting to question myself. Thank you very much. Bye.
Yeah, I had to kind of look that up, acute paranoia. I didn't even know what that means. But I don't know what's funnier, acute paranoia or the thought of Detective Duff McKagan. Or probably both. Thanks to Duff for delivering the laughs or the groans, as always. This is the third year of the Duff McKagan Joke of the Week. He hasn't missed a Friday yet since August of 2017. Think about that. Man, that's amazing. It's actually the fourth year. We're going into the fourth year here. But there's always a lot of laughs with Duff, and there's always a lot of laughs with the Winnipeggers, because coming up, I got Dave Spivak and Rybo. We're going to take a Valentine's Day trivia quiz with a very special surprise guest helping us out with that, and there will be an actual prize awarded to the winner. I know last time Dave won the AC/DC prize of Power Up, and we did the AC/DC quiz, so I better win this week. But speaking of Dave and the Winnipeggers, we released a new episode last night on my Facebook page and YouTube channel. We all took a personality test. Yes, an online personality test. Two of us had very similar results, which makes me question the validity of the test. It was way too long as well. We ended up just rushing through it, but lots of laughs. So come check out one of the most up-and-coming shows on Facebook and YouTube, the Winnipeggers. We're shopping it around to some big-time producers as well. So hopefully we're going to go to the toppermost of the poppermost. All right, coming up on Talk is Jericho very soon. Today is the best, worst movies ever. We're talking about Troll 2, and we're talking about The Room. And I've got Greg Sestero from The Room and George Hardy from Trolls 2, two of the best, worst movies of all time. I'm not insulting either one of them by saying that. They know that. And Travis Ayers, who produced the new movie Cyst, stars both Greg Sestero and George Hardy together. What a dream team of bad movies, if you will. He joins the conversation as well. So Greg and George are going to share some great stories about the making of both films, how they each got involved, the shoestring budgets they had to deal with, the surprise cult followings both movies developed in the 20-plus years since they've been released. And those cult followings are mostly due to the documentary about Troll 2 called The Best Worst Movie, and the film The Disaster Artist, which tells the story of the making of The Room and stars James Franco, which is hilarious. So before we get to the worst movie ever with George Hardy, Greg Sestero, and Travis Ayers, I have to welcome some very special guests to Talk is Jericho, my cohorts in the Winnipeggers, Rybo and Dave Spivak, and the most hated jeweler in America, Steven Singer from Steven Singer Jewelers, which is great to have you back, Steven.
How you doing, guys?
It's great. It's funny because you were on, it seems like it was only a few months ago, but it was probably a year ago, pre-pandemic, but yet you're back and doing better than ever.
Yeah, before we were wearing spacesuits when we were exactly. Life was normal.
That should be, you should sell a Steven Singer bejeweled masks. I'm sure you probably already
do. We actually have Steven Singer masks that say, I hate wearing masks.
Triple stitching?
High quality.
There you go. I hate masks.
I hate masks. Nice.
Steven Singer Jewelers. So, Steve, what's been going on with you over the last few months?
Well, as you just mentioned, the world has gone crazy. And this crazy virus and the pandemic and all this nutty things that's happened in the last year. So we, by accident, we just bumbled into something and we started to do it. And I'd like to tell you guys and that what we're doing is a win-win-win-win. I call it four wins. You buy a gift from us, any gift for Valentine's Day or for any holiday for that matter, but you buy it and we are going to take a portion of that sale. And all over the country, we've done hundreds of these already and we fed thousands of frontline heroes. We're going to get a local restaurant to cater so we can help local restaurants that are struggling that, you know, can't be open necessarily for regular business. They feed the whole hospital. So we go into a hospital all over the country. We feed all the frontline workers, the doctors, the nurses, the technicians, the people at the front desk, everybody that works in the hospital, we feed them. And I'm just pleased as punch. I mean, the reception and just to thank these people. We've gotten so many letters and email cards and texts. So it's a small little hug and it's a nice way to do it. So you can reward these frontline heroes. We can help out some local businesses, some restaurants. You can get a great gift. And then the person that gets a great gift and everybody feels good. And it mentions it in the little thank you we send out to everybody that gets or receives a gift.
That's so great, Stephen. That's one of the things about you and your store and your online presence of always kind of giving, especially during this time. So we appreciate you for that. We thank you for that. And one of the other reasons why we want to have you on the show today is because Valentine's Day is right around the corner.
Sure is.
Yeah. And no surprise, none of us have gifts for our special lady friends.
Guys are the dumbest thing. They get on the way home from work on the 13th. They'll be, oh, yeah, it's Valentine's Day. It's like, oh, Christmas is December 25th this year. Guys are just stupid. Girls, right, well, women, they get it way weeks in advance. They have everything done, set up. Guys are just so dumb. And I'm a guy, I know. Well, and I screw it up all the time. So we try to make it easy. We pull your ass out of the fire with very fast and free shipping, and we'll take care of everything for you if you are a dumb guy like the four of us.
Well, thank you for mentioning, because I forgot all about Valentine's Day until just right now, just until you said it.
Yeah, we're actually the most hated, actually.
There you go. It's the truth.
If you're talking about dumb guys, you have got three of the best here. And that's why we wanted you on, Stephen, because you're going to help out one of us by giving us a chance to win one of these brand new deep navy blue sparkling 24 karat gold dip twinkle twinkle roses. And these are great too, because I got one last year for my wife and you changed the color gold.
Right. Every year we have a different color.
But this one is twinkle twinkle, which is like
twinkle twinkle. It's a deep navy blue with little sparkles in it that mimics the night sky.
Ooh,
nice.
That's romantic, Dave.
It is.
Yes, romance is alive here tonight.
I might actually buy one for you guys.
we would expect that.
We will make sure whoever wins gets the rose. And for the two of us who don't win today, we can still go to IHateStevenSinger.com and order one of the new Twinkle Twinkle roses. But let me tell you guys how this little contest is going to work. Steven has some Valentine's Day related trivia questions for the three of us. And he's going to ask each of us individually a question. If we get it right, we get a point. And whoever has the most points when the game is over wins the Twinkle Twinkle Rose. So this is good. We did this a few months ago, Stephen, with the new AC/DC record.
Cool.
And we kept track. I think Dave won that one. But I'm up for this one. I think I'm going to win this one.
Well, the questions aren't too hard, but I'll teach you guys a little bit about love today.
Teach us about love. I think we can do this. Give us round one, Stephen.
All right, here we go. Round one. All right, Chris. How about Ribo? We'll give you the first question. What's the most popular flower for Valentine's Day?
That'd have to be a red rose.
There you go. That's it. Ding, ding, ding. It's a red rose, which is the symbol of love and affection. And I would have taken Steven Singer's famous 24 karat roses too. Either one, but that's it. That's a great one. Dave, which jeweler makes the 24 karat gold dip roses? Now, if you don't get this right, this is going to be a problem.
Carol Channing's and People's Jewelers. No, that would be Steven Singer's Jewelers.
There Steven you Singer. Go. All right. That's a good one. All right. Chris, according to Time Magazine, who is the mother of the American Valentine? Who invented it?
Kathy Valentine of the Go-Go's.
That's a good answer. Esther Howland, who started selling Valentine's Day card in 1850.
How do I get that one? These guys get Steven Singer Jewelers and Red Rose.
You're the host, man. You're the big guy.
I knew that one, man. I knew everything in the 1800s. I got this, knowledge of.
What are you telling me? Carol Channing Jewelers. What the hell are you talking about?
She used to do the commercials for Peoples.
All right. What's the next one?
All right, Dave. On Valentine's Day.
This is round two.
1967. It's a long time ago. Valentine's Day, 1967. The late, great Aretha Franklin recorded what song?
Respect.
That's it. Ding, 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 ding. Man, I would have never gotten that.
No, I would have got
that. That's a good pull. That's a good pull. All right. Chris, what year? Oh, this is tough. What year were the candy hearts invented? You know, little candy hearts that say, like, you give each other in sixth grade, you give, like, little says love or be mine. I'll give you a couple of hints.
Okay.
It was either 1856, 1866, or 1876. And this, I would have no idea.
I'm going to say 1876, widely known as the year of love.
There you go. Well, you're very close, but it was 1866.
1876, the summer of love.
You're getting all the difficult answers, all the difficult questions. But listen, that's the way they fall. All right. Ribo, which Roman goddess was Cupid's mother?
I'm going to say Carol Channing, I think.
There you go. That's close. But the right answer is Venus. All right. Let's go round three. Chris, according to the National Confectioners Association, what percentage believe that Valentine's Day candy should be either red or pink in color? And I'll give you a couple of multiple choice. Is it A, 45%, B, 55%, or C, 65%?
I'm going to say the majority would say that. So say 65%.
Ding, 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 ding. Right. Yes. That is exactly right.
So 65%.
Good pull. Very nice. Very, very nice. We're plugging along here. Okay. Ribo, according to the National Retail Federation, what percentage of Americans buy Valentine's Day gifts for their pets? And I'll give you a multiple choice as well. Is it A, 17%, B, 27%? Or C, 37%.
See, I'm gonna go 17%. Who would do that?
Well, there you go. Well, Americans are wacky. 27% spent money on, and for a bonus. You have any guess of how much it was? I'll give you a bonus add-on.
I don't know, but when I had my answer, my cat was looking at me kind of funny.
There you go. Well, 1.7 billion. You hear that? 1.7 with a B. 1.7 billion on pets Valentine's Day gifts.
You never bought Rusty a present for Valentine's Day, Ribo?
No, Christmas presents. You know, he'd get the wrappers and the box and that kind of stuff. Really happy with that.
All right, here you go. Dave, this is a good question. According to the Society of American Florists, what percentage of women send themselves a bouquet on Valentine's Day? Is it A, 5%? B, 15%, or C, 25%.
I'm depressed now. I'll give that a 15. I'll go in the middle.
15 is exactly 15 right. 15 points. You know that 15% send themselves their own Valentine's Day?
Yeah.
Okay, that's crazy. I would have never guessed that. All right. Yeah. So I have to get the total for the three rounds and see where we stand here and see if we're going to have a lightning round. And if we do, I have some lightning round questions for you experts.
Oh, yeah. You got Stacy coming from above.
Dave has three. Ribo has one. Chris has one going into the lightning round. So Dave is in the lead.
Again?
All right.
If only I could win in real life. Okay, let's go.
All right.
He's the expert on the show.
So I'm going. We're going to go to the lightning round. I'm going to name one half of a famous music couple.
Yes.
And then you have to name the other part.
Okay, we got this one.
So we'll start with Ribo. All right. Courtney Love and
Kurt Cobain.
That's it.
Woo!
All right, Dave. John Lennon and
Yoko Ono.
You got it. Chris, More current. Blake Shelton and?
Blake Shelton and Gwen Stefani.
No doubt. You got that right. You got it. All right.
Nice.
You got it. All right. Everybody got that right. So the total is from my voice in my ear from Stacy is?
Dave wins with 4, rivaling Chris tied for second with 3.
Jeez Louise. He can put that Twinkle Twinkle Rose next to his copy of Power Up by AC/DC that he won in the last contest.
Keep them coming.
All right. Well, listen, you know, there's no losers here on Talk is Jericho. So we're going to send everybody some roses and some Valentine's Day gifts to make you guys look good.
Oh, that's
and
so nice.
And then to the lovely Stacy, we're going to send her some stuff. And we're going to send you our brand new displays and lovely rose scent that goes with it. So you can build a little bouquet.
Thank you, Stephen, for doing this and for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, and you made me a hero with my nephew. Man, oh man, I told him who I'm going to be on with. Before I was a loser. Now I'm a superstar because I was on with you. So thanks a lot. You gave me some street cred. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephen. And
thanks, guys.
Speaking of losers, Ribo and I will go to the gas station to buy some presents for our wives while Dave has the brand new Twinkle Twinkle Rose to give to his. So. Thank you, Stephen.
Just have them send their own to themselves. 5%. Get them in that 5% or whatever it was. Thanks, Stephen. Nice meeting you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Take care, guys. Thanks.
All right. Thanks again to Stephen Singer of Stephen Singer Jewelers. Even though I think his Valentine's Day trivia quiz was rigged in Dave's favor, whatever. But let's get on with it. It's the best worst movie, The Room versus Troll 2 with Greg Sestero, George Hardy, and Travis Ayers right now on Talk is Jericho. All right, so this is going to be a fun show today because two of my favorite movies are The Room and Troll 2. And we have kind of an all-star lineup today with Greg Sestero and George Hardy, who starred in those respective movies, and then Travis Ayers, who is the producer of the new movie Cyst, starring Greg and George. So as much as I'm excited about Talk is Jericho having this all-star lineup, tell us about how you got Greg and George involved for your film, Travis, because that's definitely an all-star lineup, too, when it comes to a certain type of movie, if nothing else.
Yeah, so I had actually met George through his movie that came out a couple years ago called Texas Cotton. I was introduced to him by the director, Tyler Russell, and I ended up coming on doing the marketing, theatrical booking, and PR for the film. So basically since then, I've been working with George nonstop for 3 years. And shortly after I met George, I met Greg. I was doing theatrical booking for a theater here in Pittsburgh. And I actually just connected with him and, you know, had him come to the theater, do an in-person introduction. And from there, we traveled to Cleveland together. We've gone to Montana together. So had a good good relationship with the both of them. And when we were in pre-production for Cyst last August, you know, we had already locked George as the main guy, Dr. Guy, and it only made sense to bring the bad movie icons together. So I actually, you know, reached out to Greg, asked him if he wanted to play the character of Bill. And I mean, the rest is history. And it was actually cool. So the first time when Greg arrived to set, it was actually the first time that Greg and George had met in person. And that was a, you know, one of a kind of experience.
It's interesting too, because when you say bad movie icons, that's not a cut down, because obviously both George and Greg specifically has a very long resume in the movies, and George has made a lot of films too. But actually, you're still a practicing dentist as well, right, George?
That's right. I know. I just finished up this morning, and I cut it off early for you today. How about that, Chris?
Thanks, man. Did that last filling and told the guy to hit the road. You got to do a podcast.
Right. Yeah. With you too. Yeah. It's cool. Yeah.
but how is it for you guys? And Greg, I'll start with you. When you're talking about, you know, this The Room has become iconic. So to be associated with it, it's probably helped your career. Even though at the time when you first saw it and it came out, you probably thought, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah, the premiere was everything you'd expect. I mean, you had people laughing when, like, the logos came on. So I knew it was going to be kind of rough. I, like, I went into the lobby when the room was premiering, and I, like, 5 minutes in, I didn't want to see my sex scene. And so these people started walking out from the audience, and one guy looked at his friend and said, "I'll never get hard again." So at that point I knew this movie had, it had potential, but it wasn't until like years later that people started showing up and just loving this movie. And I really thought, hey, that's what everybody really hopes for, to make a movie that people love. I mean, this one was kind of twisted because they would interact with it and make fun of it, but at the end of the day, they loved it. And I thought, you know, this isn't a movie that's probably going to get you acting work if you show it to anybody. But I knew the story behind this movie, the experience I had with Tommy, meeting in an acting class, sharing that dream. I said, this would make a great book. This would make a great, you know, movie in itself. And so that's when I started writing The Disaster Artist, was trying to tell the story about the making of this bad movie and have that turn into something that's actually good. Because when you see The Room, it's sort of like a movie that an alien made after having movies explained to him. And went out, and it's like so different, it's not really accessible. And I thought telling the story about these two people that wanted to follow their dream was something human that I think a lot of people could relate to.
And how about you, George, when you're talking about, the, Greg talked about the premiere of Troll 2, what kind of reactions did you get when the movie first came out? Because that was your first film, correct?
Right. I was just stumble upon. Yeah. When Travis said, when Greg and I met, we had so much to resonate about because, for me being not the actor, I've done a few little high school plays and was a college cheerleader at Auburn, but not anything that I was, in front of the camera for, especially that length of time. It was made in 1989. And, like Greg, I didn't even watch the film until 2006, in New York City at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in its entirety, because like him, I was totally embarrassed. And, the first 5 minutes I went, oh my gosh, what's happened here? And so what happens, I made the film in 89 in Salt Lake City and then moved back to Alabama where I'm at now. I'm in Auburn right now. I live on Lake Martin real close to here. But so when I first saw the film, like I said, most all the cast members ran from it until 2006. I get a phone call from a journalist from Furman. I think it was Furman University. He's writing a radio doc. He was doing a radio documentary on the worst movies ever made. And he said, "Can I interview you?" I said, "Why?" He says, "Well, because it's number one worst film on IMDb right now." And so I said, "You got to be kidding." So I go to IMDb, and I didn't even know what that meant at the time, Chris. And because I'm back practicing dentistry in Alabama, raising a family and all that. And I scrolled to the bottom of the page, and then I kept on scrolling down at the bottom and look at the reviews. And at the very bottom of the screen, it was April the 13th, 2006, and it said, "Troll 2 cast reunion, first ever screening in the United States." So it says April the 15th. I spent $750, flew out to Salt Lake, went into a room and got tackled by Troll 2 fans. I had no idea there was an underground cult around this thing, which he explained to me about his radio documentary that he was doing. So it's kind of this disbelief thing. But then I met all the cast members I hadn't seen in 17 years. Now it's been 30 years since Troll 2's been made. And I met my on-screen son, and I said, "Why don't we do a documentary around it?" And so we did. And so like Greg, he wrote a book. We made a documentary called Best Worst Movie, which was an award-winning film. So,
Well, that's the thing that's so cool about these movies is that Greg mentioned The Disaster Artist, which obviously was a great movie with James Franco and Dave Franco. And then, George, you mentioned Best Worst Movie, which is probably one of the best documentaries that I've seen. And why I say that is because you can watch Best Worst and not have any knowledge of what Troll 2 is or even really care about horror movies or whatever. It's just such an interesting story. So you guys were both able to kind of create these great pieces of work to shine a positive light on these movies that had such a negative beginning to start out with. Travis, were you fans of both these movies, and how did you come up with the idea of getting this dream team of George and Greg together?
So in all honesty, I hadn't seen, so I think I saw Troll 2 first, and then I saw The Room shortly after. But much like George, I actually didn't see either movie until the late 2000s. So like 2008, 2009, somewhere in there, I was in film school and we did like a private screening back to back of both movies. So yeah, I didn't see it, either one, until later in life. And then when I went into like theatrical booking, I was able to see, I mean, anytime any independent theater books The Room or Troll 2, it's always like an immediate sellout. And especially with The Room, because there's always an interactive experience when you go see The Room in a movie theater, whether it's, you know, throwing forks or throwing footballs at the screen. It's a real like immersive experience. So I always just had so much fun. And then, you know, yeah, I'd started a friendship with George. And every time I would talk to George about The Room, he's like, yeah, you know, I met Tommy in the past, but I've never met Greg. So I think when Greg and I were going to Cleveland one time, I was just like, Greg, do you want me to get George on the phone? So I called George, got him on the phone, and, you know, they chatted for 5 to 10 minutes. And I could tell that there was like a relationship that needed to happen just based on that quick phone call. And yeah, sure enough, when we started going in production for the movie, I just had to have the two in there. And then another nice little addition, we actually threw in Darren Ewing, who plays George's assistant in the movie. And he is the, you know, the oh my God guy from Troll 2. So there's a whole, like, you know, Cyst has a really like cult-like atmosphere. But yeah, like I said, when those two first met, Greg and George, I mean, it was, you know, it's a one of a kind thing. And it was such a cool experience just to see those two talk. And I mean, these guys talked for hours. They relate together on everything. It just, like I said, it was a really cool experience to see them come together.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter your search based on the qualities that are most important to you. Then you can book a free 15-minute consultation call with any therapist you're interested in seeing, so you can get a feel for whether they're the right fit before you commit to a full-length session. Alma also makes it easy for mental health care providers to navigate insurance. That's why 95% of therapists in their directory accept insurance for sessions, so you can find care that's affordable without stressing about the paperwork. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy60 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy60.
All right, Greg, how did you get involved with The Room? When were you brought in, and did you know the script was absolutely awful right off the bat?
Yeah, I mean, I was taking an acting class in San Francisco. I was like 19, and I went into this class, and there was this guy who looked like Jack Sparrow, you know, after doing a little bit of cocaine. And so he went up there and he performed this sonnet that was just so unreal. And everyone in the class was horrified, and they're like, what is this? And I was fascinated. I thought, like, at that point in my life, I wanted to see something raw and intense and different. And that's what this guy was. And so I went up to him and I was like, hey, man, do you want to do a scene together? And he looked at me like I was crazy. So, and it was Tommy. And so we ended up becoming friends through, we were both loners in our own lives. We both, like, you know, we're going through a transitional period. And so we became friends, and you know, I moved to LA. I was renting his apartment, and then he ultimately was like, you know, nobody appreciate me. People don't think I look like Brando. I can be Brando. And so he just decided, you know what? I'm an independent, successful retail guy who has the money to make my own movie my way. And I want you to star in it. And I was like, oh, Lord. Because I'd been auditioning for things. I'd done a few things. And I knew this, you know, this movie probably had no shot at any sort of success. It's written by one man. He wants to star in it. He wants to play this young 25-year-old guy. He looks like a vampire, but he's the leading man. And so he wrote the script. And honestly, the original draft of The Room is one of the funniest things I've ever read. Like, I've done a few events where we read the original script with audience members, and it's just like, it's pure comedy. But again, he meant for this to be a drama. So when he said, I want you to play the lead role of Mark, I was like, you know what? I'll help you make this movie, but I don't think I'm right for it. And so that's how it started out. We ended up trying to cast the movie. We found the whole cast. Everybody was ready to go. And then the night before filming, he's like, look, if you don't make this movie, it will be biggest mistake of your entire life. You will miss the boat. And I'm like, but we already have another guy playing Mark. He's like, no, you know what we do? He was shooting the movie on film and HD, two cameras side by side, never been done before, beyond pointless. But anyway, he's like, we'll roll film on you and we'll roll digital on the other Mark, shoot the scenes twice and just delete the digital. And I'm like, dude, this is the worst plan ever. So going into making The Room, I you know, didn't think anybody would ever see it. And really it was like the night before filming that I was like, you know what? I guess I'm going to be on set all day helping. May as well do it. Nobody's going to see this movie. So for me, it's probably like 17 years later that people still love this movie. It goes to show anything's possible because I didn't expect anything from it. And I didn't think anybody would ever see it, let alone was it good or bad. So it just goes to show when you go out to do something creative, you know, the sky's the limit because we have no idea how it's going to be received.
You just never know what's going to connect with people. So George, tell us about your how you got the gig with Troll 2.
I know. Like Greg, I was taking a few fun acting classes in Salt Lake City. And one of the people in my aerobics class says, why don't you come and one of my students come and take some acting classes. So I took lessons from a lady named Lillian Chauvin. She was Raquel Welch's coach and several other celebrities out in Los Angeles. She flew out to Salt Lake and we do little scenarios. And so one day I got a phone call that there was an audition up in Park City. And so after I was practicing dentistry, I went up to Park City and auditioned. I walked in this smoke-filled room of 9 Italians and no one spoke English. And the room, I couldn't even see the director. Mind you, I'm in Utah, right? Nobody smokes at all. But there's so much cigarette smoke in the room, and they give me a cold script to read. I had no idea what I was doing. And I like your energy. I like your energy, he says to me. And then the next day, you know, you get the part for the lead as far as the dad goes. And I went, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. So like Greg, you know, I would say, you know, if you're going to ask which one's the holy grail of both of them, I'd say maybe there was some cynicism or something was cynical about The Room. Ours is so innocent because really what we were trying to do, we're all non-actors in Utah. I got paid $100 a day for 13 days. And, you know, we were just trying, we were all trying to make a really good movie, but we couldn't understand the script. And so we were trying to decipher what it meant. And, you know, the last scene in the movie is shot the first day. It was so discombobulated. I had no idea what I was doing. There was no direction. We were just winging it. And like Greg, you know, when we, I don't know, there's so many similar stories here when I hear him talk about all this and just the bizarre sets. And we had stale pizza. I remember for 2 or 3 days, we had pizza on the 3rd or 4th day, the same pizza from the first. But anyway, so we had this relationship that we'd built with a lot of Italians. We had translators there with us. And we just made this thing and I had no idea really, Chris, what was going on until about day 4 or 5. And I'm sitting at a table in a seance and I look down and there's green icing on corn on the cob. And everything's green. You know, if you watch Troll 2, you guys, there's no trolls in Troll 2. They're goblins and they're disguised as human. And if they eat us, we'll turn into if we eat any of their food, we'll turn into plants. They're vegetarian goblins, and then they'll eat us. So the whole attempt is trying to get us to eat their food. So anyway, bizarre story, right? And so here we are in these, you know, phenomenal, you know, it's just happenstance that Greg and I, that this happened to us. And now here we are, you know, for me, 30 years later, you know, talking to you on one of the best podcasts in the world, you know. Wow,
this is amazing. But here's the thing, and you see this in Best Worst Movie, the director, Claudio Fragasso, and Tommy Wiseau kind of in interviews, they get kind of angry when people refer to this as a bad movie. Like they still, and maybe Tommy's changed, Greg, you can speak on that, but I know in the documentary, like when people infer to Claudio, the director, that this movie sucks. He's mad. He's like, no, it doesn't suck. It's great art or whatever he says.
Yeah.
Does Tommy still feel the same way, Greg?
I think Tommy still believes, you know, it's a great movie. I mean, I still think he, you know, people say, how does it feel? It's the worst movie ever. He's like, you know, the room can be whatever you like. It can be happy place. It can be bad place. But I don't believe it's a bad movie. I mean, he justifies.
That's great, man, by the way. It's perfect.
Yeah.
All the decisions he made, like, for example, we were making Disaster. I was like, one of James Franco's favorite stories about the set. Well, I was telling him, Tommy built a $6,000 private bathroom on the set, like with a curtain. And he's like, why? How? Like, there's a bathroom like 75 feet away inside. And he's like, because King has to have his own quarters. Hmm. And we're just like, he never used the bathroom, but he saw it as that, like, I need my space. And he totally sees it his way. Like, he doesn't think like, oh, I'll go back on that and defend it. So he truly believes the room is like commercial mainstream cinema. And that's what's kind of fascinating about it, is all these years later, like, he still holds his ground. Like, you know, we shot a rooftop scene in a parking lot with a green screen when there was like a rooftop, like right there, you know, that we could have used. He's like, because we do first class Hollywood, we like to do green screens. So it's just a different mind. And I think that's how we get this entertainment, is nobody would have allowed these movies to get made the way they are if they weren't calling the shots. So I guess it's, you know, it's a prop towards originality, if you want to look at it from in a positive way.
So, George, and this is almost the same for Greg, but I'll ask George first. When you show up on set, and obviously it's an Italian horror movie being made in Park City, Utah, and why wouldn't it be? When you show up there and see the goblins, not the trolls, and like, dude, like, these goblins are terrible. Like, it's the worst. Like, it's like somebody, like, just, it's not even, they made paper mache faces or something. How do you still hold on as an actor and go, like, this is the shits? Like, you still got to try and make it good.
I know. I did want to add one last thing. Claudio and Rossella, now we're 10 years out since we've made Best Worst Movie, which was a challenge when we went over to Italy to film the documentary. We thought that, you know, they were embarrassed, but now they know they're in on it. And they love it.
Finally.
They love the fact that everybody loves it all over the world now. And they love the fact that there's world fans everywhere. But yeah, you're right. So when we go on set and there's burlap sacks and and you just go, oh my gosh, the wardrobe here is, it's hurting a little bit. And, you know, we knew it was low budget. And so we just went along. We were just so innocent. I mean, I was 34 at the time, and I don't know. It's just, I look back on the whole experience, and I just, it was a 3-week shoot, and, you know, we're just trying to make a good film there in Utah. There's they call Utah the beehive state, which they're busy as bees down there, you know? So, everybody was busy as bees trying to make a really great movie. You know, we didn't care. We were just in a film. We were glad to be in a film, right?
That was your first one. I mean, absolutely. I can see that for sure. Yeah.
How was work today?
Oh, pretty good. We got a new client at the bank. We make a lot of money.
What client?
I cannot tell you. It's confidential.
Oh, come on. Why not?
No, I can't. Anyway, how is your sex life?
How about you, Greg? You mentioned the rooftop scene. There's so many classic moments, but when, you know, Johnny comes out of the rooftop staircase and he's yelling that he didn't beat the woman. He didn't beat the woman. And he just, oh, hi, Mark. Like, when you see this dialogue and you see it delivered, are you thinking like, come on, dude?
I mean, I had this sort of advantage to have known Tommy for 4 years before we made this. So everybody on set thought this was a legit production. We were filming at Burns and Sawyer in Hollywood. And so their shock happened when we would show up 4 hours late to the set, because Tommy would bring home the camera every day. So people would just sit around until we showed up. So we'd show up about 4 hours late and he would run in like, why isn't everything set up? Why are you wasting time? So everybody was just kind of like, dear, what is this going to be? And so when we shot that rooftop scene, I knew Tommy's great when he's hosting Q&As and he's free to kind of do his thing. But when you get him on a set, he's got to hit his mark, say a line, hit the next mark, look up. I knew it was going to be a problem. So we get in there and he's like walking out of that like little shed, and he's just, like, he can't say the line and do it properly. And so I was just sitting there watching all this go down and just trying not to laugh, because everybody like behind the scenes was like, dude, this has got to be a joke. We're like, on take 20, and he hasn't even said the line properly. And so that's when I kind of got up and gave him the water bottle. I'm like, hey, you know, Tommy, what did you always tell me? Show emotion, throw this water bottle. He's like, that's a great idea. My God. And everyone's like, wait, why is there a water bottle in there now? I'm like, just trust me. So he comes out, he nails it. And I'm sitting there watching this. We do my coverage. I start to laugh. So in the movie, you see me like picking my nose because I'm trying to cover my face from laughing. And then they put that in the movie, which is even better. But it was like combination of that. And then the sex scenes, of course, like, one of the big things, Tommy, was like, you know, this movie has to be American. And you know what? I really need to show my ass to sell this movie. And I thought it was like kind of a half joking thing. And he's like, no, I think I would go for it. James Dean would do the same thing. And I was like, you know what, Tommy, you're right. And sure enough, 10 minutes later, he's naked shooting this scene. And I was like, oh shit, I'm an enabler. But I mean, he was kind of right. Like, those are the moments that people still talk about. And I mean, the crew was like in disbelief most of the time. But I think looking back now, it's sort of like a fun memory to look back and say, dude, I was part of like the biggest train wreck that has ever taken place in Hollywood.
George, how about you? What were some of the, you mentioned that the director couldn't speak English. So what were some of the directions that you got for your scenes?
Oh, I know. When you say train wreck, I think about how do you put lightning in a bottle twice? You know, that was our little thing that we said, but yeah. But, Claudio, big like spider bite you, big like spider bite you, big, big spider bite you, spider bite you. That's all he can say. He gets right in your face and spits on your face. You know, because we had no language. I mean, now, because Claudio spoke a little English now. Claudio is, I can call Claudio on the phone and we have a nice conversation, of which we've tried to make Troll 2 Part 2, if we could, return of the bologna burger or something like that is what we want to do. I think I own a burger factory or something, a manufacturing a burger factory, which is what they give a bologna sandwich to the goblins, if you remember at the end, and that's what kills them.
Yeah.
Like the Wizard of Oz, the witch, you know. Oh my God, that's such a great scene. But yeah, all of it, you know, it's just the way it was all pulled together, and like Greg having all these, I mean, I didn't know film like Greg at all. I was just in there just like, oh, what do I do? Yeah, I'll do whatever you say. I'm in a movie, you know? So, yeah. But the costume design, I think Laura Gemsler was their costume design lady, that she's a pretty famous actress over in Italy. And there's I can remember, you know, just the language barrier was the main thing, which, you know, Rosella, who wrote the script, they're both absolutely lovely people. And I've been in Rome 2 times now to meet with them and have dinner with them and all. And she doesn't speak any English. She understands, but does not speak English. But Claudio and I now have a nice conversation, and he would love to do something again. You know, they've made about 40 or 50 movies now in Italy. I think they're pretty well. Yeah.
When you talk about Tommy, Greg, there's always kind of some controversy as to A, where he's really from, and B, where he got the money to spend on the room. Because you mentioned there's all of these, like, filming in digital and film is ridiculous. I mean, not to mention super expensive. That's 2 camera crews and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Did you ever know anything about that, or is it something he kept very close to his vest?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a lot. Like, I did a lot of research when I was writing The Disaster Artist. It was almost like kind of trying to solve the Zodiac case. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that was fascinating to me is he put a billboard up in Hollywood for 5 years. And that was just insane to me that, like, you know, that's like Tom Cruise still promoting like Vanilla Sky. But but I, you know, he was a really successful retail guy back in the 80s, I think, which he had told me about. And then he was just saying, you know, I get tired of retail. Now I want to do movie. And he just, their money was no option. I mean, we shot that Chris R scene, the drug dealer scene, in an enclosed alley set. And he watched the dailies and he's like, it's not dramatic. We need to reshoot on roof. And so we shot 3 weeks that scene, just like an alternate version. So I feel like with Tommy, the more I've looked into it, it's always like blind alleys. You find a little bit of truth and then it's like, you have no idea where that goes. So I feel like he's such an interesting mystery that he's sort of not meant to be solved. And I think that's what kind of adds fun to the room, is wondering, who is this guy? Where's he from? Where's he really from besides New Orleans? And where did he make his money? It's sort of like the mystery is the fun part of the room. And so I kind of gave up trying to solve the whole thing and just accepted, you know, he's a 30-year-old guy. He's from New Orleans and he's just really good at designing jeans. And that's that.
Travis, when you hear all these different stories about what George and Greg are talking about as a producer, how do you not do this when you're making a movie like Cyst?
It's kind of hard, but with any smaller budget picture or independent movie, there's a lot of things that go wrong on a movie set. And, you know, sure enough, that did happen on Cyst. But I think the biggest thing that really worked on our end for Cyst is everyone that was on the cast and crew, all of us had already worked together. We were already friends. So you create this like family environment. And I think that protects us a little bit from having these experiences like, you know, George did in Troll 2 and Greg did in The Room. So I think it's a lot of times it's the people you surround yourself with. But, you know, everyone, like I said, everyone was like a family. And yeah, you know, you have your little hiccups here and there, but overall it was a very, very pleasant experience.
And you kind of have to have that. I mean, you mentioned a little bit of that, George, when you guys were filming, you know, and you're in Park City and it's a fairly big cast, but did you get pretty close to everybody while you were filming Troll 2?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Which was really kind of nice because, okay, you've got to imagine that I'm away. I've moved back to Alabama, started to practice. So when Best Worst Movie was made, the documentary, I took on the great task of being the social chairman, meaning the intent was to go back and interview all the cast members, which was very difficult. Several of them didn't want to have anything to do with any kind of documentary made around a really bad movie. They were still embarrassed from it. And until we got them into New York, we had about 9 cast members in New York City, I think, and that's when the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater did a screening. It was really the first big screening, as you saw in the Best Worst Movie, the documentary. I think 300 people came that night from all over. I think even from Hawaii and South Carolina to see this incredible, you know, thing happen on screen, you know, much like The Room, you know, it's just like Greg talks about in the audience, to be sitting in the audience. He and I have done it so many times together and just be able to be a part of it, you know, of the enjoyment. It's almost as if, I'm sure for Greg, I'm not, sometimes I don't, when I watch The Room, or I mean, when I watch Troll 2, or really any of the films that I'm in, but when I watch Troll 2, especially, I forget it's me. So I'm in there having a blast with everybody else, you know?
Yeah. It seems kind of a different thing because George, you're talking about Troll being made in Park City on a low budget. And Greg, you're talking about, you guys are filming this in LA where budget's no concern. Does it have the same family atmosphere, or is it more just people getting in and getting out and getting their paychecks?
I think with The Room, we went through like 4 crews. They people would just not stop quitting. And so I think a lot of the first crew expected something professional and they saw they were getting madness. So I think they, you know, collected their paycheck and got out. And by the time we got to the 4th crew, it was like a smaller indie team that knew what they were making and was able to get through it. But I think, I mean, The Room was such a surprise. Like each day you didn't know what you were going to get. You know, you'd have a different crew and Tommy would fire cast members and then people started replacing each other. So it was just a circus on The Room. And I don't think the crew had any hopes for it. It's not like they were putting their heart in. I think really the only person that was really going for it that saw this all the way through was Tommy. And I think that really shows, you know, obviously in the end product.
Do you see this writing? Do you know what it means? Hospitality. And you can't piss on hospitality. I won't allow it.
Well, What are you going to do to me, Daddy?
Tighten my belt by one loop so I don't feel hunger pains. And your sister and mother will have to do likewise. Okay, Joshua, you want to get rough with me? You want to show me that you don't like the choice of this house for our vacation by going on a hunger strike? Well, I'll accept the challenge. But just remember, when I was your age, I really did suffer from hunger. We'll see who gets through this. But just remember, I've got more practice than you. I'll see you tomorrow.
When you guys, like you mentioned, especially in George's case, it's a great part in Best Worst Movie where Troll starts becoming more well-known. And now George Hardy, the dentist who made this weird movie 20 years ago, is now kind of a celebrity. How was that for you as a person? How was it for your family? Did it affect you at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, to this day, I have patients that come in that want, you know, the dad from Troll 2 to clean their teeth, you know, look at their teeth. So I've had people flying from Minneapolis. I've got a dentist that was a huge fan, and he flew down, had his teeth cleaned in my dental office. I remember that. And pharmacists came in from Nashville. And, yeah, so, you know, that people locate me because of, you know, they know I've got a dental practice, I guess, from the documentary and all that. So, yeah, but as far as being recognized, it's kind of surreal probably for Greg and myself. I can remember going to a lot of the screenings and, you know, you go in and watch these people kind of adore you. And then you walk out in the street, you walk on the street, nobody knows who you are, you know, mm-hmm. not that it played any part with my ego at all. I guess philosophically for myself, it's not that I needed to make any adjustments with it, but it was a part of really accepting the what is about what happened. And, you know, for me, you know, my emotional part of it for me, Chris, more than anything would just be, I mean, Deborah Reed, who plays the witch in Troll 2, she says to me, she says, well, if you can't be in the best movie ever, why not be in one of the worst? And really, she's really right. And so this is kind of a miracle that, we, you know, Greg and I both, I mean, there's probably been 100 million movies made, and both of us are recognized from being in that. But out on the streets, no, every so often, people hear my Southern accent or voice a little bit from the movie, or, you know, and then now with the white hair and all, I still, you know, people do recognize me here and there. And we were opened up. The Best Worst Movie was the Sidewalk Film Festival's opening film in Birmingham. So a lot of times when I go to Birmingham, people recognize who I am. But how about for you, Greg? Is that what happens to you when you walk out on the street?
Well, I mean, the whole reason that I had a beard in the room was that if this movie ever came out, nobody would recognize me. So I was planning way ahead. But no, I think ever since The Disaster Artist came out, with how much, you know, how well received that film was and how much publicity, I started to get, you know, recognized a lot more, like in very random ways. Like I was in Norway, I just got off a red eye flight and I was walking in the almost empty airport, and this guy comes up from behind me and he goes, "So anyway, how's your sex life?" And I look at him and I'm like, "Wait, what?" He's like, "Oh yeah, he's Norwegian." He's like, all my friends go up, and we, you know, in the winter time, we go up to this cabin and watch The Room and get high. And I just thought, man, that's great, man. I'm happy to see that it's made it all the way to Norway. So it's one of those movies that when people get it, they really get it, and it's got sort of a viral feel to it. You want to show your friends and get that shock value. So it is, you know, it's 2003, and The Disaster Artist, obviously, it spread a lot. So, you know, you run into it.
But you only had a beard for half that movie.
I know.
It was disappeared.
Yeah, I tried to keep it the whole time, and Tommy was just like, "Look, we need to shave beard. You look more American, all American guy, tuxedo. You have to do it." And at the time, I had this girlfriend who hated the beard, and we were kind of, you know, weren't really doing well. And I thought, all right, I'll shave and that'll help the relationship. It didn't help the relationship, and it got rid of my disguise. So,
but you never actually had a scene in the movie shaving it.
I know. He made me go into the bathroom, the real bathroom in the building, and he recorded my shaving, like trimming and shaving, and he's like directing it, saying, "Don't cut your face, be careful." So we have that on BTS, but I just show up unshaven, unannounced. It's pretty great.
So tell us a little bit about Cyst and when did you make this movie? When is it being released and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, so we actually started pre-production right around the same time last year, so like mid to late September. We ended up shooting in Baltimore in December. We did a 3-week shoot, and you know, it just finished the final version last month. And next month, we will actually be premiering in a bunch of places in the UK, a couple of film festivals, and then we actually have a theatrical booking in Australia because they still, you know, they have theaters that you're allowed to actually go in right now. But yeah, besides that, lots of just popping up. We're going to try and do some drive-ins because those are really thriving again right now. And yeah, I mean, Cyst is a, you know, it's a 1960s throwback where a doctor invents a cyst removal machine, and in typical horror fashion, it backfires on him and he inadvertently creates a cyst monster. So, you know, fans of stuff from the, you know, the original Blob to the Blob remake in the 80s, all the way to Reanimator. And then more recently, we've had a few people view the film and almost unanimous have basically referenced that it reminds them of Little Shop of Horrors, which I had never seen before. So I had to watch it. And then, you know, yeah, it's kind of crazy because Steve Martin's character is actually a dentist. So the connections there were kind of uncanny. But yeah, it's a cool mix of all these movies, you know, even, you know, hints of Twilight Zone. So it's just a good old school fun horror movie. And George really steals the show with some of his lines. I mean, I think there's lines in Cyst that are going to, you know, overshadow some of the things that he says in Troll 2. So that's very exciting for all of us.
George, what was the big differences between shooting Cyst and shooting Troll 2?
Oh, well, I mean, you're looking at 30 years, of course, but like, yeah. Things were a lot more organized and put together. The very talented Tyler Russell wrote and directed the movie. And I've worked with Tyler before. I met Tyler, first of all, when we filmed in Mobile, Alabama. He asked me to come down and shoot with Here Comes Rusty. It was a film on the Greyhound racetracks. And, Travis, help me out with who's in that.
Fred Willard. Yeah, we've got Bruce Hampton, and actually, Chris, one of your previous guests, Mark Burchard, actually is in Here Comes Rusty.
Mark Burchard, for sure.
And then we went on to do Texas Cotton, of which we did the short, which I did with Mark Burchard, and also one of your big fans is Judd Lorman, who's on SEAL Team, by the way. We did a short before we did Texas Cotton, and so Judd, I got to meet Judd, who is in Texas Cotton with me, and he plays Blackburn on SEAL Team, and big professional wrestling fan. But anyway, he wants to be on your show one of these days. You'll have to get Blackburn on.
Only the biggest stars, man. Only the biggest stars get to be on my show.
He's getting up there. But you know, fast forward to Cyst. You know, Tyler really is. He's just got such a creative mind. I think, from what I understand, when he was 11 to 15 or whatever, he just played video games all the time. So a lot of the film, you feel like you're watching a video, a really true, you know, live video game, really on screen with Cyst, kind of. Yeah.
How about you, Greg? What are some of the big differences between filming Room and filming Cyst?
I think it would obviously, you know, organization, that's kind of a given.
Yeah.
But I just think how much fun we had. It was, everyone worked really hard, but everyone knew what they were doing. And Tyler even threw it to me. He's like, hey, you want to try directing this scene? And I'm like, hey, man, I get a chance to direct George. But yeah, it was just a really fun experience. And I think it shows in the movie because I'm a huge horror fan. That's one of probably my favorite genre. And I just come off directing my first horror film. So I was in that horror mindset. And when I showed up there, just the way they captured like the 60s period was really smart. And it was just, yeah. I mean, I think when you make a movie, it's going to be stressful. It's good. There's going to be a lot going on, probably a lot going wrong. But at the end of the day, you want to just be having fun. And that's what I think with Cyst. We all had a great time.
Yeah.
All right, Greg, I didn't realize that you wrote the book, The Disaster Artist. Did James Franco and Seth Rogen buy the rights from you, or how did that movie get made? Because it was a great one.
Yeah, so the book came out, and James Franco and Seth Rogen were making The Interview at the time up in Vancouver. And so a producer had given James the book. He had never seen The Room before. And he just started reading the book and thought, dude, this is the craziest Hollywood story I've ever heard of. Is this even real? Sure enough, The Room was playing like that week in Vancouver, and I was there doing a book signing. And so James came to see The Room for the first time, having read the book, and we talked. And he's like, I really want to make this. I really want my brother to play you. And we had a conference call with Tommy, and I was like really nervous because I had no idea what he was going to think of this. And he's like, you know, so who play me, James? And I'm like, oh dear God. He's like, I think Johnny Depp is good idea. And so James kind of laughs, and Tommy's like, why you laugh? Was so funny. He's like, oh, I don't know. He's like, you know, it's the biggest movie star in the world. He's in Pirates of the Caribbean. And Tommy's like, so what? You don't know, you don't try. Why don't you go this direction? And I'm like, what about if James plays you, Tommy? And Tommy's like, that's okay. That's a good idea. Maybe, you know, I've seen some of your movies, James, some good movies, some bad movies. And so we had this the craziest conference call. And then, you know, James said, I've read a lot of books and this is the movie I want to make. And Seth Rogen's going to produce it, and we're going to put together a great film. And James was true to his word. And a few years later, you know, they ended up making it. But I thought it was even better that James had come to the story through the book rather than having seen The Room. Because I think, you know, to make The Disaster Artist, you really need to tell a universal story about, you know, friendship rather than kind of making a movie about a making of a bad movie. So I thought they did a great job handling adapting the book.
It really is. It's been a year or two since I've seen The Disaster Artist, but there's a really great scene near the beginning where Tommy shows up to pick you up and you're in the front yard just hanging out in the suburbs. And it's just a really cool, like, he wants to be your friend so bad. He's going to, whatever, he's coming to pick you up or get in the car or whatever he said. It was just really, that was really painted really well.
Yeah, it was, you know, when I first met Tommy, I mean, we went out, he's like, I need to eat. If not, I get cranky when I don't eat. Yeah. And so we go have lunch. The whole thing's kind of weird. And then we really connect when we went to the park to play football. I mean, I know that sounds really weird. We were supposed to be meeting to be like rehearsing for our acting class, but we end up playing football in a park. And that's where I kind of really got to see the human side of him, where he's like, you know, you can be big actor if you just, you know, believe in yourself. And I'm like, this is so bizarre that this dude is like actually giving me inspirational advice, you know, cause I'd just gone out for a bunch of roles and not gotten them. And he was the one person who made me feel better, ironically, when he was the guy in acting class that everyone saw as sort of like the villain. And it was just strange that we bonded over football. So goes to show, in acting classes, you might not learn how to act, but you might, you know, get cool experiences.
Well, there's definitely a lot of football in The Room. There's like 18,000 passes at all times with the ball. Where is Tommy now? Did he ever make another movie? What is he doing?
Yeah, I mean, we still talk quite a bit. I mean, he'll check in with me. He's doing his retail business. A few years ago, I actually wrote a script for Tommy for him to play like a mortician vampire. And I called it Best Friends because I thought, hey, nobody's really given Tommy a chance to be an actor in a role that fits him. So we went out and made these movies, Best Friends, Volume 1 and Volume 2, and they're completely insane. And that really got him excited. And now he wants to make a new movie called Big Shark, about a shark that attacks New Orleans. So I don't know.
it's called Big Shark?
Big Shark, yeah. Right. I mean, Big Shark. He's great with titles, The Room, even though it has nothing to do with The Room. but he's, you know, he's still, that's where he's at, is Big Shark. He thinks, you know, make big entertainment action movie. So,
man, you mentioned that billboard earlier. I drove past that billboard probably 50 times, like you said, over the course of 3 or 4 years. And I was like, fucking hell, man, when are they going to take this thing down? It's always there, but it's not playing anywhere. It's just there at all times.
Oh, you know? Yeah. Only in theaters. And then it had his number on it. It's like RSVP. So you'd call it and you'd get the answering machine and it'd be like him disguising his voice and say RSVP for this movie. I think a lot of people just thought it was like for a cult, you know, like, right, you know, call this and join this cult. But yeah, 5 years is unprecedented.
It kind of is a cult, though, you know, the cult of The Room.
It is.
Just starting to wind down here. George, you mentioned the Best Worst Movie. We talked about that a lot. How did you guys get that made? Because it was very successful, much more successful than Troll 2, I would think.
Yeah, I know it. I think 98% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
Yeah, we filmed that, of course, over a course of 3 years, and it was organic with friends and family putting it together. And we filmed it in 28 cities in 8 countries. Mm-hmm. So we went to Austria and found Troll 2 fans in Austria. We went to Paris and London and Birmingham, England, and as you see in the film, we went all over. And then we went and we filmed screenings of Troll 2 and the reaction, like, you know, you see with the room and, you know, just people that adore it. But what's really interesting more than anything is what I have found is people that love bad movies. And, you know, I have found that, you know, you've read articles about people, you know, you wonder what kind of people are attracted to really bad movies. And I have found some really amazing people in the audiences that have written pet books. Mrs. Renfro's Salsa, the world's largest salsa, the CEO of that, the huge fans. There's a lot of people that are of high intelligence just come in and love these films. They love talking about it, like you, you know, just love laughing at something. And I think that the world needs, especially like now, you know, we need laughter in our lives, and you know, and I just we, you know, we're laughing, not we don't feel being laughed at. We laugh with, you know. I think Greg and I both do now. You know,
well, it's great when you see the description for Troll 2, and it's built as like a comedy horror or dark comedy. I'm like, bullshit! It was not supposed to be a dark comedy. They're just saying that now.
Yeah, but, right.
But you can respect the fact that, like, I always, like, when you're talking about Tommy, you're talking about Claudio, I always like put myself in the shoes of the artists, as we're all artists here. And it's like, these guys had the best of intentions. Like you said, it's going to be Citizen Kane. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be Halloween. It's going to be the greatest movie. And then when it doesn't turn out that way, I understand why that would bother them at first. But then when you embrace it, like you said, you've created a piece of cinematic history. Even though you wanted it to go this way, it's still very important to thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands of people around the world.
Yeah, and that's what Claudio's point that he makes in Best Worst Movie, that it is art. Whether you like it or love it, it's still art, you know.
Right.
You know that as a musician.
Have you seen The Room, George?
Oh, yeah. Yes, been a while, but yeah, and The Disaster Artist, and read the book, yeah.
Have you seen Troll 2, Greg?
I've seen scenes of it, but I saw the documentary, which I felt like what you said earlier, that almost gives you the best of it all, you know, is seeing seeing Best Worst Movie. But I have watched scenes of Troll 2.
And like you said, when you see Best Worst Movie, I think that's the most of Troll that you need to see, because it's got a lot of highlights in there.
It does.
As we start to wind out, last two questions. What is your favorite scene from your movie, whether it's Troll 2 or whether it's The Room? And I'll start. Obviously, to me, the scene where the kid, you can't eat the food, because if you eat this food, you're going to turn into a plant. And then the kid needs to save his family, so he does what anybody else would do. Rather than just sweeping the food off the table, he gets up and pees on it. He pisses on it. And then angry father, George's character, picks up the kid, takes him upstairs, throws him on the bed, says you can't piss on hospitality, then gives a big speech about being hungry as a child.
Hungry, hunger pains. Right, good for you.
I've got more experience than you do in being hungry and starving. And it's like, what's going on here?
Exactly. You know, and that was a big mystery to me, is I really wanted to meet Rosella, because Rosella wrote the script. And I thought, Rosella, please tell me, how did you come up with this idea? How did you come up with these ideas? The languaging, everything. And so when they translated it from Italian to English, it went straight Italian English, like almost Google right now translating. But you know, do it like this. Do the line like this. You know, there wasn't any American translation. It was just do it as it was supposed to be written.
What's your favorite scene from Troll 2, George? Or your favorite part?
Oh gosh, it might surprise you, because for me it was my experience that I had. And I'm coming down the steps, and for me, I just laugh at it, because we did that take like Greg said, about 20 times we did that. And I was still early in the morning. I walk down the steps, and I'm buttoning my shirt up, and I go, "It's breakfast ready, dear." And everybody knows just about every line of Troll 2. And I go, "It's breakfast, F-I-R-S-T, is breakfast ready, dear? And I just laugh at that every time I hear it because I remember trying to do, I never could say the line, you know.
You got that Alabama accent kind of too, right?
Exactly, breakfast. Yeah, it's a drawl, you know, whatever you want to call it down here, you know.
I also love the subtle name of the town is Nilbog, which of course is Goblin Backwards.
Yeah, exactly.
When you talk about the room, you briefly mentioned it where Tommy sits down and says, I don't even remember what the line is before, like, oh, I'll have a ham sandwich. How's your sex life, Greg? Like, out of nowhere. I'll let you expand about that. But my favorite scene is when he comes into the floral shop and the lady goes, oh, Johnny, I didn't recognize you. And it's like, why?
It's how many vampires shop here?
Goth vampire with long hair. He's not wearing a mask. He doesn't have a ponytail. He didn't grow a beard. It's like, it's him. It's so obvious it's him. What's your favorite scene, Greg?
What's amazing about those scenes is we weren't even supposed to film those. It was like we'd wrapped in LA and it felt like Tommy didn't want the movie to end. So he's like, we need to go to San Francisco and shoot scene about Johnny Mark, talk about love, Johnny buy flower for Lisa. And I'm like, come on, dude, we don't need those. So that was the last scene we ever shot for the room was the flower shop scene. And I was at a live screening and it was packed. And everyone was yelling throughout the entire movie. And when that scene was about to come on, everybody in the audience went, shh. And they all went quiet so they could actually like hear it and listen to it. And that's when I thought, okay, there's got to be something special about that scene. When we were filming it, I didn't think anything of it. We had the makeup artist. It's like the only extra. And we showed up to this flower shop and Tommy's pitch was, hey, you know, if we buy flowers, will you let us film movie? Will you play yourself? So literally, we just showed up at a flower shop and shot that scene. It goes to show, making movies, hey, it's not really that hard. But I think probably my favorite scene of the room that I think kind of encapsulates the entire madness is the drug dealer scene. Because you got a guy up there playing basketball with no hoop. Drug dealer shows up. We have no idea why he's there. And he just says, I don't have 5 minutes. Where's my money? Where's my money? Then randomly, Tommy and I magically appear on the rooftop. And it's sunny behind us, but it's cloudy every other angle. And we come out. We disarm this drug dealer who's armed and clearly would throw both of us off the roof with, like, one arm. And then the Lisa and her mom appear magically also at the door. And then we carry this guy to the police station. 30 seconds later, we're back, like everything's taken care of. And it's just like, it's sort of like a bad after school special about not taking drugs. Right. But it's just, you show that scene to somebody and their face is just, you can just see the questions turning and they're like, okay, I need to know how this got made. And I think probably the Chris R scene is one that I always enjoy watching with the crowd.
Another good one is Lisa's mom out of nowhere where she's like, yeah, I got my test back. I have breast cancer. Anyways, they just drop this huge plot point and then just move on and never mention it again.
Yeah. And Tommy's thing was, you know, people have cancer. They don't like to talk about it. I'm like, he's got a point.
They like to mention it, but they don't like to talk about it. I'll tell you what, man, my one of my best friends and I for weeks and months, even now, one of our favorite quotes, going to make a movie, Greg. We're going to make a movie, Greg, from Disaster Artist.
Yeah. Hey, that's still happening today. I see still is like, hey, we need to make Big Shark. People need it. So hey, not much has changed 20 years later.
How about you, Travis? Which movie do you like better, The Room or Troll 2?
So it's a tough one. So I guess there's two different answers. I'll say The Room, if it's an interactive screening in a sold-out theater, just because, you know, a lot of theaters do it differently, but usually it has kind of like what you said with like a Rocky Horror effect where it'll have cues for, okay, now you throw a football or now you throw anytime you see like a spoon, you throw a spoon. But I think my favorite thing about that is because there's so many, you know, transition shots of San Francisco, and the cue for that in the theater is meanwhile in San Francisco. So like, I think interactive room experience is great. However, I've probably seen, since I've actually watched it for the first time, I've probably seen Troll 2 more, just because it slightly borderlines being a horror film, although it's, you know, it's really not. But yeah, I gotta say that, you know, Troll 2 is my favorite, And one of my favorite lines that George says is the daughter, you know, sees Grandpa Seth in the mirror, and George comes in. He's like, "Have you been smoking dope again?" And it's just like, to me, it's just the funniest to hear George say that. And after knowing him, it's one of the funniest things that like you could ever imagine.
Especially again, like she's smoking dope all the time.
Right, right.
So when does Cyst come out, Travis, and when can we find it?
Yeah, so Cyst, we're going to do a theatrical probably next month, as well as some festivals. You know, hopefully, I would say within, you know, hopefully before 2020 is over, if not early 2021. But yeah, no, it'll be streaming, DVD, Blu-ray, all that stuff. And then, yeah, we're hoping to make Cyst 2. So hopefully that happens as well.
You got
to
make Cyst 2, but there's no cysts in the actual sequel.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the appropriate thing to do.
Last question for George and Greg. Why do you think your respective movies have translated so well? And here they are 20, 30 years later and people still getting together for screenings. And you know, you guys' careers have blossomed because of these movies. What do you think it is about The Room, Greg, that people like so much?
I think it's just, it's so unfiltered. It's made by a man who sees the world in a completely different way. And it's sort of relatable to see this person shoot for the stars and end up like as something that's so bad that is, you know, you can see the passion that's put in it. And I think all of us realize, hey, we all have dreams, and this guy went for it and made something that is like very human and so different. I mean, nobody would have okayed any of these choices that he made to do The Room. And I think it's just refreshing to go in and watch this movie and see it for all that it's worth. And I think there's just something about it when it comes to movie making. Certain movies just have a quotable rewatchability, and it's just, I mean, it's seeing Tommy. Nobody would ever cast Tommy in a film, and it's just getting to see something so raw and unique that I think people just enjoy getting that laugh with their friends and that shock value.
Well said. How about you, George? Why does Troll 2 still resonate?
I think it just delivers. Troll 2 just simply delivers scene to scene. You know, you just go, for the most part, when you watch it, you just go, did that just happen? That didn't just really happen. You know, like you said, the pissing on the table, or, you know, then you go from this scene to that scene to the next scene, and you just go, that you've got to be kidding me. And it's just, I think it's so, like I said, it's their bellyache laughing. And I think that's what the whole world needs now. And that's why these movies stay with people. I wanted to ask you before we get off real quick, What do you have a favorite? Do you have a favorite really bad movie? You know, what about you? I know there's a lot, but do you have
any? These are two of them, man. I mean, and I'm not just saying this, and they have been for years. But there's a lot of bad movies, especially when you're a horror movie fan. There's something, you know, Sleepaway Camp movies. All three of those are pretty bad, especially Sleepaway Camp 3. You know, I think a couple of the Hatchet movies with Victor Crowley are pretty bad. But those movies are just bad. Like, they just don't click. There's something about it. But these movies are bad in a different way. Because, like you said, there's a movie called Things that I just did for Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs. That's literally bad. It's the shits. No one should ever watch it. The master should take a hammer to it and destroy it. You know, London After Midnight with Lon Chaney from 1939 has disappeared forever. Things needs to follow it. These movies are not that type of movie. Like you said, you can watch these and appreciate the artistry, but and also laugh at just the ridiculousness of it as well. And that's why it's so cool to have you guys here today and to be able to talk about this. And I'm excited to see you working together. It's a dream team, man. Well, thanks a lot, guys. And we'll be sure to check out Cyst when it comes out. And George, I think your Tesla is probably charged by now.
It is. Yeah, charged.
23 <There you go>. Thank you, guys.
Thank
Pleasure
you.
Pleasure talking to you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Can I help you?
Yeah, can I have a dozen red roses, please?
Oh, hi, Johnny. I didn't know it was you. Here you go.
That's me. How much is it?
It'll be $18.
Here you go. Keep the change. Hi, doggy.
You're my favorite customer.
Thanks a lot. Bye.